It's Wednesday, January 4th, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Happy New Year! I'm Mike McKean, subbing this week for Amy Simons as we come to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Joining me for our weekly roundtable on news media performance are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Ernest Perry and Stacey Wolfel. Well, what better way to start the new year than with a major, though not unexpected, shakeup in the TV news business? Megyn Kelly told her audience last night she was ready for a position that would give her more time with her young children.
So I'll be leaving Fox News at the week's end and starting a new adventure, joining the journalists at NBC News, who I deeply admire. I'll be anchoring a daytime show there, along with a Sunday night news magazine, and you'll see me there on the big nights, too, for politics and such. I am very grateful to NBC for this opportunity, and I am deeply thankful to Fox News for the wonderful 12 years I have had here. I have grown up here and been given every chance a young reporter could ever ask for.
Kelly's last day at Fox is this Friday. It's unclear when she'll start with her new employer. The terms of the NBC deal weren't released. Fox News reportedly was willing to pay Kelly $20 million a year to keep her. CNN and ABC News were also said to be suitors. So, Stacey, you've worked for an NBC affiliate. Why NBC? What's she going to be doing there? And more importantly, can she make it work?
Well, what we know about it so far, we don't know that salary. It's probably between $15 and $20 million. That's a lot of money to tie up on one person. But she's going to do a daytime talk show of some sort. Has not been announced yet. And then, as she says in the clip, they're a Sunday night magazine. The reason to get her, I think, is a little cynical, maybe. Andy Lack at NBC, I think, wants to try to attract the Fox News audience to come over to NBC, and I just don't think that will happen. They're two different beasts, and bringing Megyn Kelly over, who, frankly, put off a lot of the Fox loyalists with her battle with Trump, probably won't pay off. And that daytime spot, there have been a lot of people who they thought would succeed have failed at that. You know, if you look at the two people who have been most successful, Oprah and Ellen, they're very different people than Megyn Kelly.
Yeah, and if you look at news people, I mean, you've had Katie Couric gave it a try, Anderson Cooper gave it a try, Meredith Vieira gave it a try. None of them survived afternoons on local affiliates. Why is that?
Well, first they have to get the local affiliates to clear the program. Not everyone will, probably, because if they're running Ellen, why would you give up Ellen to run this program? So they have to get them out on the affiliates. And then I think people at that time period are looking for a personality that's probably a little bit warmer than Megyn Kelly, and if her approach is hard news, which I assume it will be, that doesn't seem to play in that time slot.
Yeah, I'm curious, Ernest. I mean, there was some talk at one point that Fox News, and especially the new CEO, James Murdoch, was trying to kind of moderate Fox News a little bit, and Megyn Kelly was going to be their star, even if they had to jettison Bill O'Reilly, for example, to do that. Well, obviously, that plan's out the window.
Well, I think there was just too large of a gap to cross there from what happened with Megyn Kelly and Trump. To what happened with the exit of Roger Ailes and her involvement in many of those allegations. And I think at some point, either she made the decision that I need to go and do something else. It may have been mutual and said, hey, you know, we need to move on. And I also think this sort of goes back to what Stacey was talking about is, are you going to jettison O'Reilly to keep her, or vice versa? And I think that what Fox has established is more about the brand than it is about one individual person. And if it is going to be an individual person, it's probably going to be O'Reilly.
I guess you'd have to say it probably could have turned out differently had Donald Trump not won the presidency. But now there's talk that Fox is looking to replace Megyn Kelly with a, quote, pro-Trump conservative woman. So seems to me like we know where they've put their chips, and it's had at least the election has had a lot to do with that, I would think.
Yeah, and I think Fox probably would like to not have as big as celebrities. They'll play O'Reilly and Hannity out for as long as they can, but those people are expensive, and Megyn Kelly was expensive, and if they could put somebody cheaper in there who couldn't take that brand then to NBC or someplace else, that would be a smart business decision.
And the other part of that is that, you know, you always run the risk when you create these stars that either they're going to do something or something's going to happen that's going to put you in a negative light that's going to start costing you viewers. I mean, we saw that with NBC and Brian Williams.
Yeah.
So you always run that risk. And this is the thing that sort of has me a little concerned about NBC bringing Megyn Kelly in is that, you know, CBS tried this with Katie Couric. It didn't play out very well. Talked about Brian Williams. They were just starting to sort of recover from that, and then now they move in this mm-hmm. direction. I mean, you open yourself up to that happening again.
Right. I mean, I think we could all agree at least that Megyn Kelly started out the new year in her new job with a classy kind of announcement. I don't think we could say the same thing about another cable news anchor. CNN's Don Lemon teamed up with his colleague Brooke Baldwin for some on-air partying and drinking at a New Orleans bar on New Year's Eve.
Tequila for everybody. We'll do one for Anderson and Kathy back.
Okay, here.
What are you guys doing here?
We're here for New Orleans, yeah!
Are you guys going to have a shot for us?
A little shot?
Brooke, are you
yeah,
safe?
Yeah, will you... Anderson, what's your shot?
They can't hear us. They're in danger. I feel they're trying to send us signals. Like they're in danger.
This is for you. We're about to be in danger with those shots. Good Lord.
This is for you. I hope you guys are counting how many times he's doing this. Yes, yes. I'm up to 13.
Well, we don't know how many shots Lemon actually downed, but as the night wore on, he seemed more and more loopy. He got his ear pierced after Baldwin talked him out of a nipple ring. He confessed that he was ready for a new love interest, and depending on who you believe, CNN might have even cut off his microphone after Lemon said, quote, 2016 was awful. Now, I mean, Stacey, granted, CNN has made a name for itself on New Year's Eve with this sort of over-the-top programming with Anderson Cooper and Kathy Griffin, but I'm wondering if you think Lemon's apparent drunkenness maybe went just a little too far.
Yeah, we've all been newsroom managers, and so somebody needed to pull the plug on that a lot earlier. You have Kathy Griffin or somebody to provide that over-the-top because she's not one of your news people. You can let her do what she wants. She comes in one day a year to do that. So if you watched any of this, Brooke Baldwin was horrified, I think, all the way through. Maybe she was drinking. I didn't watch enough to see if she was. But somebody, a manager early on, needed to go pull Don out. Brooke could have done fine by herself there. She seemed to be managing and put an end to that. And why they let it go on as long as they did, I have no idea.
Well... But this is Don Lemon. He has done this over and over and over again to where he wants to make himself the center of attention, even on hard news stories. He's somehow, some way made himself the center of attention, and he did it again. And I'm with you. A manager should have pulled him out and said, okay, enough is enough, because now we're sort of drifting into things that are going to hurt our brand. This is going to hurt. It's not going to hurt our brand. It's going to hurt you when you... the next week are sitting on this, in the studio trying to have a serious conversation about the Affordable Care Act.
But I mean, to be cynical about it for a minute, maybe they don't perceive that there's going to be any lasting damage for the CNN brand or Lemon's brand.
Maybe not. You could argue that everybody was talking about CNN the next day. And ABC and Mariah Carey, those were the two things that came out of New Year's Eve that everybody talked about. I felt bad for Brooke Baldwin, who had to try to keep some level there. It may have hurt her a little bit, just having her attached to it.
Well, I must say, I was a bit disturbed that CNN, and for that matter, Fox News as well, didn't cut into all of this revelry on New Year's Eve to do any kind of serious reporting on the Istanbul nightclub shooting. Now, that was going on. 39 people died. We knew a lot of folks had been killed. And that story was breaking at the same time that CNN and Fox were partying. Should they have broken in with more coverage on Istanbul?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was going on earlier. It was going on at night in Istanbul, which was in the afternoon here. It started at that time. And so I think it's a problem that we've run into is that they probably didn't have anybody on to cover it. They probably let people off for the holidays and a small staff.
Well, I think that's part of it. But I also think that it's one of those things where they just didn't want to deal with bad news. There's been so much bad news going on over the last couple of weeks involving bombings and killings and that sort of thing. And maybe they just wanted to just say, hey, you know what? We covered it in our evening newscast. Let's not cover that as we lead up to the new year.
Well, I think we again can agree that it wasn't Lemon's finest hour, no matter what the repercussions. But there was another journalist here in the new year who was earning a lot of praise, and that's David Farenthold. He's the Washington Post reporter who discovered that the Trump Foundation was buying art from the president-elect's country clubs, and he wasn't giving very much to charity. He also was the one who received that video that showed Trump and Access Hollywood's Billy Bush talking about assaulting women. Well, late last week, the Post published Farenthold's inside account of how those stories happened. Nearly 3,300 people have commented on the article so far, and surprisingly, most of them have urged him to keep up the good work as Trump moves into the Oval Office in a couple of weeks. So I'd just like to, first of all, hear a little bit of your reaction to that story itself, sort of the inside details about how he managed to put those two stories together.
I thought it was a great textbook, reporter's textbook. We could print it and hand it out in class, frankly, in terms of the steps he took and also just seeing how the chain went from link to link going forward. I'm not sure it's as an interesting read for somebody who's not a journalist, but for me it was fascinating to go through and see, you know, some things fell in his lap, but certainly it was a lot of hard work to get everything that he got.
I agree with you in terms of the steps that he went through. And you don't see a lot of that. I mean, people see the finished product. They don't see what it takes to get there. And you don't really see a lot of this kind of journalism playing out. But I think people are, from the comments, people are appreciating that and they want more of it. Where I see the issue coming up with the next president and what's going on is whether or not journalists are going to be able to have the kind of access, whether or not sources are going to be willing to engage with journalists in that way, because you have the president-elect, soon to be the president, out talking about having an enemies list and blackballing reporters and all these other things. I mean, not only is that going to stifle journalists, it's also going to stifle sources. And that I find very disheartening.
And we're going to get into that in just a bit in a little more detail. I'd been following his reporting on the Trump Foundation fairly closely, but I was surprised at a couple of bits that came out in that story, one of them being how much he used Twitter to reach out to other folks for tips. For example, he used folks to track down where one of the controversial paintings was that turned up, I think, in Miami at the Doral Country Club, right? And also, though he didn't dwell on it in much detail, he did talk about the fact that he received death threats as a result of this and how his family reacted to it, having a consultant say things like, well, your cars are too far away from the house to worry about a car bomb, but maybe they'll cut your brake lines and things like that. So it does sort of say that the environment that journalists are working in today when they're covering these kind of sensitive stories is really a lot more freighted than it used to be.
It is hostile. And of course, we all remember the threats of violence against reporters at Trump rallies. And, you know, with him coming into the White House, we wonder if people don't feel emboldened to carry out some of those. So the one good thing I think that comes of it in hearing about those sort of things is the T word, transparency, by having the transparency to see the reporting process and what the feedback he got, good and bad. I think it adds to understanding in the public to what we do and what we put up with, and maybe a little sympathy.
And I think it's also a good thing that you're starting to see from this, which, you know, you could take it for what it's worth, is that reporters are willing to go on Twitter, go on Facebook, go on social media and talk about when their lives are being threatened or when their reporting is being threatened, to let the public know, hey, this is what's happening. I'm trying to report this story to provide news and information for the public to see what our government officials are doing. And this is what is standing in my way of doing that.
Well, in relation to all these challenges that we've been talking about and some others as well, John Avlon wrote an interesting piece recently. He's the editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast, and he says that this is our Murrow moment. So what did he mean by that, and do you think that analogy is an apt one?
Good.
He was talking about Murrow's times with McCarthy and his ability to show the world what McCarthy was really about. Sadly, I think the media world and the public have changed too much since then, that it would be nice if we could have this one voice or frankly, the broadcast media or any media be able to broadcast the truth and have everybody sit back and realize what was going on. But we're too fragmented. We're too polarized, too partisan. There's no way to have a Murrow moment again.
But I mean, Ernest, even, and you're our resident historian, back in the day, everybody kind of has this memory now of Ed Murrow's, you know, almost reverential. But, you know, when he was calling out Joe McCarthy, or when he was talking about how TV needed to be more than wires and lights in a box, the public and his own employer weren't actually treating him very well.
No, they weren't treating him well at all. I mean, and Murrow was under a lot of scrutiny. And I mean, he was being followed and investigated by the FBI. He was being called a communist by several different organizations, including some within journalism. He was the one journalist who sort of was able to rise above that and get that information out. But there were other journalists who knew what was going on in terms of McCarthy. They weren't able to do it because they didn't have the backing of their employer, and they were had minor ties to communism that were blown up, and that stifled their journalism. So, you know, we talk about the polarization of today. There was some of that back then at that time, but I think what one of the differences is that people went to television, the infancy of television news, but they got a lot of their news and information from radio and from newspapers, and that was where they got the information. Now people are getting information from all different sources, and people tend to go to the source that sort of confirms their own political biases, and I think that is a huge difference between Murrow's time and where mm-hmm. we are right now.
Well, I mean, maybe even if we are able to call up the courage and the tenacity and maybe get the attention that Murrow did, I don't know that any of those things are possible. If we have to rely on leakers and whistleblowers to help us cover the Trump administration, one of today's top investigative reporters, James Risen from The New York Times, wrote an interesting piece recently. He says that journalists can thank the man who's about to leave the White House for those problems, basically saying Barack Obama has set it up for the next president to be able to crack down on the press if he wants to.
I would say two things about that. That's true, but George W. Bush set it up for Obama's administration, and Bill Clinton set it up. All presidents have really worked against this. Back when I was the chairman of the Radio Television Digital News Association, we had a meeting with George W. Bush, and one of the things we brought up at the meeting was a federal shield law that would protect reporters from revealing sources and other things, and he just flatly killed it. Not interested at all. I mean, he didn't even pretend that, oh yeah, we can talk about that. So we were very excited when Obama was elected to say, here's a president, seems to be about openness. Shut it down immediately, too. No president is interested in this.
And in fact, what Obama ended up doing is trying to prosecute 9 different people, which is 3 times as many as any president before him. So there really is a legacy there for Trump to build on that's frightening for journalists, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Stace is right. I mean, Clinton did a lot in his term to do that. But I think George W. Bush ratcheted it up with 9/11 and the war on terror and the Iraq war and on and on and on. And when we move into the era of the Patriot Act, and what that set up is where we are right now, where you have not just the presidency, but all aspects of government are looking at how do I keep as much information as I can classified so that I can, i.e., protect the public from anything that's harmful out there that could come back in the form of a terrorist attack or you
right.
name it.
But there are some worrying precedents that have come forward. That federal appeals court in the James Risen case, in fact, basically said there's no such thing as a reporter's privilege to protect his sources. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court even ordered him to testify before the Obama administration finally backed down. I guess maybe they didn't want the headlines of a New York Times reporter being in jail. So, I mean, I just wonder, do you think that President Trump will build on these precedents, given what he said about the media in the past?
Yes, he will. He will build on this. I mean, I'm just thinking about the Risen case. If Trump had been in office as opposed to Obama, Trump would not have minded at all if Risen went to jail. He would mm-hmm. have played that up.
Well, another concern you brought up a few minutes ago, Ernest, as we enter the new year, is just how much access the White House press corps will actually get to the president-elect. His counselor, Kellyanne Conway, said this week on ABC News that the press corps is going to get the traditional daily briefings, but then the incoming press secretary, Sean Spicer, was talking to a conservative radio talk show and said business as usual is over. He talked about doing more Facebook town hall meetings, more on Twitter, and maybe a lot less routinely with the White House press corps.
Yeah, I think the White House press corps is going to face some challenges. I mean, Trump has not been, as a candidate, he didn't make himself available to the press the way that most traditional candidates have. I don't see him doing that as president. I think there'll be fewer press conferences, if any. Mm-hmm. I think that there will be fewer briefings, if any. And I also think that he's going to try to figure out ways in which to control the flow of information and only go to certain sources and pretty much eliminate talking to others.
I think we're seeing a little bit of the pattern right now that Trump will tweet overnight, early in the morning, and then reporters will chase what the tweets are about all day. I think it's already happening.
And the other thing is the press pool. I mean, you know, the press pool was set up as a way, and as I'm speaking now as a historian, as a way to sort of document what the president does on a day-to-day basis. He's pretty much thrown that out the window. He's like, I may tell you when I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. I may not tell you when I'm leaving. It depends on how I feel when I wake up in the morning. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Secret Service loves it, but I'm pretty sure the press doesn't.
I just worry that large swaths of the public are going to say, you're just a bunch of whiners. You know, we don't trust you anyway. It's great that he's going to public media and going directly to us and not filtering it through the mainstream media. Well, anyway, there are quite a few stories out there and issues now that news organizations have maybe a little more degree of control over. And I'd like to discuss a few of them very briefly. So let's start out with fake news. And we're not going to say a lot about it. We've talked plenty on this show. But I do think it's interesting because for a long time, the focus has been on conservative media, been on examples like the story of the pizzeria in Washington, D.C., and the guy coming in with a gun trying to liberate a non-existent child trafficking ring. But conservatives have been pushing back the past couple of weeks, for example. For example, they say this example of a guy who is a hoaxer on YouTube who got on a Delta Airlines flight and then he claimed that he was bumped off because he was speaking Arabic. Has even fake news lost its meaning? Has it been so scrambled up that it's really an issue we can't deal with effectively?
Well, here's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that now that we're actually talking about this fake news in the open, that people are going to go, wait a minute, is that true or is it not? And start doing their own checking. Because during the election and even before that, people would just look at something and take it at face value. Mm-hmm. But now that a lot of this fake news has been exposed, I think that people are going to, I'm hoping that people will start questioning what they're hearing, what they're reading, and what they're seeing, and then going out and trying to verify that themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I try to talk about with the public any chance I get, which is we need media literacy education to start very early. It's too late for adults at this point to get it in school, but they can train themselves on it. And I hope that's a very common term. I hope when they get to at the end of this year and they talk about the terms of the year, I hope media literacy is right up there with fake news and people are talking about it.
I do too, but I also think journalists kind of need to educate themselves going into the year ahead. Mm-hmm. One of the stories that we've talked about on this show a bit, where I think we did a lousy job, frankly, in 2016, is covering the global rise of populism. And there's an interesting clip on our links blog for folks maybe to check out. CNN international correspondent is basically saying, last year, journalists just didn't listen. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, we saw Anthony Bourdain, of all people, if you saw that, I think in the past week, said, we in our liberal elite East Coast bubble, we're not East Coast, but we might fall into some of those other categories, willfully ignored these people. And he says he travels around and gets to talk to them, and they're not dumb rednecks as they're often portrayed. And so when we have a celebrity chef telling us how to be better journalists, we probably have really blown it.
Well, we talked about this on the show, and I was reading a story over the break that talked about how journalists have fallen into the analytics side of journalism, the numbers, the polling, and that sort of thing, in the same way that sports writers have fallen into the analytics when you talk about baseball and football and all the fantasy sports and that sort of thing. And we stopped talking to people because we were interested in what the numbers were saying. So I think that's part of the reason that we sort of failed in this. We need to really go back out and start talking to people.
I just hope that when journalists say that they're learning, that it sticks. I just worry that when we're talking about covering Trump or Brexit or people who are worried about immigration, that journalists don't kind of look at them as insects or zoo animals, you know, specimens rather than, you know, part of their audience. Well, let's talk for a moment about the fate of local news in 2017. Newspapers and TV stations have been cutting back on their state and local coverage. Small publishers are being bought out by conglomerates who are focusing more and more on the bottom line. I wonder, Stacey, as somebody who was a local news director for a long time, is 2017 going to be as bad as we think when it comes to local news trends?
Yeah, you know, I pay more attention to local television news, and staff size has stayed pretty steady there. If there's a cut, it's that they're doing more news with the same number of people. And so the staff is spread a little more thinly and can't get out there. And I worry about all of the experience that we're losing as the more senior people in newsrooms either retire or are forced to retire because they want to hire newer, younger people. And so often I see mistakes when I'm watching news, local and otherwise, and I know that that's coming from inexperience of the people there, that they've lost the experienced voices in the newsroom.
So what's your hope, and does it differ from your expectation about local news in the next year?
Well, I am concerned about it in terms of newspapers, because I think what's happening is that more and more of the local newspapers are being bought up by larger conglomerates. I mean, here in Columbia, Gatehouse has bought the Tribune, and they're going to transition to a morning newspaper in February. So what kind of impact is that going to have on the way in which we get our news and information? But when you look at those small newspapers across the country, what you're starting to see is that their staffs are smaller. They're covering less and less news. You're seeing more of wire copy that comes from other places, and that's not the news that people in small local areas need to have.
Well, since we've spent most of our time today talking about stories that are negative or divide us, why don't we finish this show on one that's all about uniting us? Muslim Americans are justifiably concerned about 2017 may bring more angry words and actions, a possible ban on immigration or travel some parts of the world. And meanwhile, some of America's biggest companies are using a new round of video advertising to promote inclusion. You've probably seen that Amazon commercial where two friends, an old priest and an imam, are sending each other knee pads to ease the pain while they pray. Well, that message was pretty clear, as is this one. It's a spot from Honeymade Graham Crackers that features a Muslim mom in a hijab.
The first time you go out of your house, you're worried. Is anybody staring at you? Is anybody looking?
I didn't know anything about her culture, only what I saw in the news.
I was kind of scared of how she's gonna accept me, but then our girls brought us together.
What we share is the thing that matters most.
Honeymade, this is Wholesome.
And Microsoft, Chevrolet, CoverGirl Cosmetics, some of the other companies that over the holidays were running these sort of ads about inclusion. They going to make any difference?
Yes, I do think they're going to make a difference. Our politics may not get the demographics, mm-hmm. but our advertising and our marketing and our corporations get the demographics, and they understand that this is the audience we need to reach in order to be able to become to maintain our profitability. And I think that's where these companies are going.
Yeah, and it just normalizes things for in people's mind who might not think that way, that aren't exposed to it, don't read it in the newspaper, but they see it in those commercials and they start to add up. And so it has an effect whether people realize it or not.
And let's hope that they keep up the good work despite the trolls in social media that are always hammering them for these kinds of ads. Well, that's our time for this week. You can read more about the topic we discussed today on our Links blog. It's under Programs tab at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and Lowell Thomas for directing the program today. And thanks, of course, to Stacey for joining this week's panel. I'm Mike McKean, Amy Simons, Ernest Perry, and I are all going to be back next week with another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.